Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. It's really good to be here exploring something incredibly rich and meaningful today.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to this one. We've got a fascinating collection of research, some really detailed notes to get into, taking us to a very specific time and place.
That's right. Today, we're focusing on the Afrin region, northwestern Syria. And we're looking at its vibrant narrative traditions, use of stories, epics, legends, but specifically those that shaped the culture before the year 2010.
Yeah, that pre-2010 time frame is absolutely critical here. Our sources really narrow in on this period.
And our aim today is pretty straightforward. Pull out the most important insights from these materials. We want to truly understand this incredible cultural landscape, and maybe even more importantly, why documenting it became so vital.
Let's just, you know, paint a quick picture. We're talking about Afrin, nestled there in the Kurd Daw, the Kurd Mountains.
Right.
And the sources are clear. Before 2011, this area was overwhelmingly Kurdish. Some even describe it as, well, almost homogeneously Kurdish.
That long history, that continuous presence.
Yeah.
It's the foundation, isn't it? The bedrock for all the stories we're about to talk about.
Exactly. Those deep roots are key. And the research really emphasizes that Kurdish folklore, broadly speaking, is almost completely oral.
Almost entirely oral. Wow.
Yeah. It's incredibly rich, incredibly diverse because it lived through community memory, through active performance. In Afrin, this wasn't just like an idea. It was really the main way stories were kept alive.
And we see that so clearly in the notes, don't we? There's that testimony from Zarifa Hanan.
Ah, yes.
An 86-year-old woman from Afrin. The sources highlight her specifically how she actively preserved stories, things like Siyabendu Gese, and passed them down to her kids, her grandkids.
It shows the vitality, doesn't it? It's not abstract history. It's living, breathing tradition flowing through elders like her.
And the historical context itself plays a huge part here.
Yeah.
The sources suggest Afrin had a unique path. Before 2011, it was largely spared the Arabization campaigns that affected other parts of Syrian Kurdistan, at least to a more significant degree.
That's a really crucial distinction the sources make. It doesn't mean total isolation, of course, but this relative insulation. It probably helped maintain a stronger core of those indigenous Kurdish narratives.
So maybe less dilution compared to regions facing more intense pressures. Pressures aimed at, you know, altering cultural identities.
Exactly. And that's why this pre-2010 time frame is so incredibly important. It acts as a baseline.
Okay.
It represents the cultural memory as it existed in a relatively stable indigenous environment before the major disruptions hit.
Yeah, I mean, the Syrian civil war from 2011, and then, of course, the Turkish military operation and occupation in 2018.
Right. Which brought displacement and serious concerns about cultural alteration, heritage loss.
So documenting this specific period, it wasn't just academic.
Not at all. The researchers are clear. It's about capturing that cultural memory before the displacement and fragmentation really threatened everything. It's fundamental to cultural preservation.
A record for the future.
Yes, bottling up that collective memory, the values, the worldview embedded in these stories.
So what were those defining stories? Where do we even begin with the major narratives that were central to Afrin?
Well, you almost have to start with Mem-Uzin. The sources consistently present this as the Kurdish national epic.
Emadizani's poem from way back in 1695.
That's the one, originally written, yes.
Can you give us the core story, the quick version?
At its heart, it's a profoundly tragic love story. You have Mem and Zin deeply in love.
Right.
But their love is constantly thwarted by this villain figure, Beko. He's jealous, manipulative, and ultimately his actions lead to their deaths. It's heartbreaking.
But it's so much more than just a sad romance, isn't it? The research really emphasizes its deeper meaning in Afrin and Kurdish culture generally.
Absolutely. It functions as this powerful allegory, an allegory for the collective suffering of the Kurdish people, their yearning for unity, their long struggle for self-determination.
And Zani himself, didn't he intend it partly to give the Kurdish language a real literary cornerstone?
Precisely. To elevate the language, give it weight. And the connection to Afrin, it's explicit in the materials we reviewed. Mem-Uzin wasn't just some distant legend. The sources listed as known, retold by Afrin residents.
There's that specific anecdote, too, about Fidan Mamo.
Yes, the 52-year-old woman. She grew up hearing it, told it to her own children, and she reflected on its tragedy, seeing it mirror how, you know, societal realities, external forces can crush true love.
That's powerful. Seeing your own life or the life around you reflected in this ancient epic.
And what's fascinating is the journey of the story itself. It starts as this written poem, But in places like Afrin, it becomes a living oral tale again.
Adapting, changing slightly, maybe.
Probably adapting to local contexts, yes. Becoming deeply local while still being this shared cultural touchstone, reinforcing identity, reinforcing collective memory.
Okay, let's shift to another huge one, Kawa the Blacksmith. Tied so closely to New Rose. This feels absolutely foundational.
It really is. Cornerstone stuff. The legend tells of Kawa, a blacksmith, could be seen as an ordinary man in some ways, who rises up. He leads a revolt against this incredibly cruel, tyrannical King Zaha.
Zaha, the one with the snakes?
That's him. Often depicted with serpents growing from his shoulders, needing to be fed human brains daily. Horrific.
Right.
So Kawa, using his hammer or sometimes his leather apron as a makeshift banner, he confronts Zahak, defeats him, and then he lights these bonfires on the mountains.
Signaling freedom.
Signaling freedom, exactly. And the arrival of spring, new life.
The symbolism is just immense there. Resistance against tyranny, courage, liberation, renewal. And all of this culminates in New Rose.
The spring equinox celebration, which became, as you said, the most significant Kurdish cultural holiday. A celebration of freedom, of identity, of new beginnings.
And the sources, they specifically mention vibrant, deep-rooted New Rose celebrations in Afrin.
They strongly attest to it, yes. Which tells you just how deeply embedded the Kawa legend itself must have been there. Celebrating New Rose, invoking Kawa. It wasn't just a party.
It was a reaffirmation.
A profound reaffirmation of identity, of collective consciousness, of aspirations, especially important, you can imagine, in context where cultural expression might have faced restrictions.
Okay. Now, what about Shamaran? She's a fascinating figure, known across the wider region, right? Half woman, half snake.
Indeed. Shamaran, or Shamaran, queen of snakes, often seen as a symbol of wisdom, protection, deep, hidden knowledge. Really captivating figure.
And the legend generally goes.
Typically, it involves a human, often a young man, who stumbles into her hidden underground realm. He gains her trust, learns incredible wisdom from her.
Sounds positive so far.
It starts that way. But then, often, tragedy strikes. The human is forced, maybe by a sick king needing a cure, or sometimes through weakness, to betray her location. Her death follows, but often her wisdom is transferred, maybe through consuming part of her body, but usually with, let's say, mixed consequences for the betrayer. Karma, perhaps.
You have themes of wisdom, sure, but also trust, betrayal, sacrifice, healing. She's often seen as this powerful, resilient feminine symbol, too.
Very much so.
What do the sources say about her in Afrin before 2010? Was she as central as Memuzin or Kawa?
This is where the sources we have are a bit more nuanced. They definitely acknowledge Shamaran's importance in broader Kurdish folklore. She's very well known in other regions like Bapur, northern Kurdistan.
But not explicitly named by Afrin residents in these specific texts.
Not in the same direct way as the others, no. The provided texts don't have, say, an anecdote like Zarifa Hanan telling the Shamaran story. However, the sources make a strong case that she was highly likely known there.
Highly likely. Based on what?
Based on Afrin's strong overall Kurdish cultural fabric, its geographical and cultural links to other regions where she is prominent, like nearby Mardin, and just her general presence in Kurdish mythology.
Even across different religious groups within Afrin.
Right. While the main religions noted before 2010 were Sunni Islam, Alevism, and Yazidism, cultural symbols and stories like Shamaran often cross those lines, become part of a shared cultural understanding.
So if she was part of Afrin's lore, what significance might that hold?
Well, it would connect Afrin to these even broader ancient myths of Mesopotamia and the Kurdish world. It offers another layer of symbolism, maybe a metaphor for cultural survival, for enduring wisdom persisting despite adversity. But the sources are careful here. They suggest this is an area where more specific local research would be really valuable to confirm her precise role in Afrin's pre-2010 traditions.
Okay, that makes sense. Let's shift gears a little bit then from those grand epics and myths to the love stories. The sources seem to suggest these held a particularly special, cherished place in Afrin's oral tradition.
Yes, the Anabalati article our sources draw on really highlights this. It identifies four key love stories that people in Afrin apparently knew widely right from childhood.
Which ones were they?
Siabando Zise, which we mentioned, Memuzin again, but viewed here specifically through the romance lens, Zembil Firos, the basket seller, and Ferhad Ushinin.
And the sources pointed out a striking common element across many of these, right? Something about the endings.
Yes, it's hard to miss. They frequently feature thwarted lovers and tragic ends. Really often.
Not exactly cheerful.
Not cheerful, no. And the sources suggest this isn't just random melodrama. The tragic outcomes are often attributed to external forces, societal constraints, or, as one resident, Fatima Khalil, is quoted, the interference of sick characters.
Wow, sick characters.
Yeah, and she apparently felt these tragic endings reflected a harsh reality, a world where true love often couldn't win against those external obstacles.
That's a really powerful insight. It makes you wonder, though, why would a community embrace so many sad love stories? Why hold on to them?
Well, the sources offer some thoughts on that. They suggest these stories might function as like cultural mechanisms, mm-hmm. ways to process collective experiences of loss, hardship, maybe thwarted aspirations.
So a shared language for difficult emotions.
Exactly. Creating a shared emotional landscape, a way for the community to understand suffering and perhaps build resilience together. They fostered cultural cohesion through shared sorrow, shared narratives of defiance, even in love.
Let's look a bit closer at Siab and Utesi again. The sources really emphasize its centrality in Afrin.
Oh, deeply embedded. Remember Zarifa Hanan, the elder?
Yes.
The sources use her testimony here. She recalled this story vividly from her own youth, told it to her grandkids, and specifically admired Sayaman's courage in eloping with Sese.
The basic story being their elopement against opposition, and then their tragic death together, often near Mount Saipan.
That's the core of it, yes.
The themes feel so raw, defiant love, courage, sacrifice, maybe fate.
Absolutely. And what's interesting, as the sources note, is how interpretations could shift. Zarifa saw Sayaban's act as pure bravery, mm-hmm. but apparently a film adaptation framed it more as reckless, which just highlights how fluid oral tales can be.
And Seiza's choice, choosing to die with him.
Often seen as the ultimate act of loyalty or maybe defiance against a world that denied their love, it seems to resonate with that recurring theme of pushing back against constraints, even if the end is tragic.
Then there's Zembelfiros, the basket seller,
yeah.
also listed in those key four, sometimes linked to the poet Fiqué d'Iran.
Yes, that's right. And this one, it offers quite a different feel.
Yeah.
The story is about a prince, but he rejects his royal life, the power, the corruption he sees around him.
Okay.
He chooses humility instead, becomes a simple basket seller, and his journey becomes one of spiritual steadfastness. He has to strongly resist temptation, particularly from a powerful woman who desires him.
It sounds a bit like the story of Yusuf or Joseph.
It's often compared to that, yes. The themes here are really distinct from the others. Piety, humility, integrity, the dignity of simple labor, and a profound rejection of worldly corruption.
So what makes this one stand out amongst all the tragic romances? Why was it so popular?
Well, its unique angle is that it's a story of moral triumph. Spiritual resilience. It's not about a tragic end caused by external forces thwarting love.
Right. It's about inner strength winning out.
Exactly. The sources speculate its popularity in Afrin might reflect a deep cultural value placed on inner virtue, on living a principled life, maybe even a subtle critique of unjust or corrupt authority figures.
Interesting. And the fourth one listed was Ferhad Ushirin.
Ferhad Ushirin, yes.
Oh.
An adaptation of a very famous Persian romance, which found its own life in Kurdish tradition.
What's the story there in the version known in the region?
According to the sources, the popular version involves Ferhad, often a highly skilled craftsman or sculptor who falls deeply in love with Princess Shirin.
Okay.
But to win her hand, or perhaps just prove his love, he's given this impossible task, something monumental, like carving through a mountain to bring water to the palace.
Moving mountains for love, literally.
Literally. And he pours everything into it, nearly succeeds, but then rivals, or maybe the king himself, deceive him. They send false news that Shirin has died.
Oh, no.
In despair, Ferhad kills himself, often with his own tools. And then Shirin, hearing the truth of his death and the deception, dies of grief. Another tragic end.
The themes there are just incredibly intense. Unwavering love, that monumental effort, but also the terrible consequences of deception, jealousy, and again, sacrifice.
Very intense.
Why do you think this particular story resonated so strongly in Afrin alongside the others? What did it offer?
Well, it certainly fits that pattern of intense devotion met with loss due to external interference. Love is shown as this incredibly powerful force, capable of immense feats.
That moving mountains.
Exactly. It highlights perseverance. But it also serves as a stark cautionary tale about the destructive power of malice and lies. It echoes those recurring themes of intense love and tragic loss found in other Afrin lore.
So beyond these major epics and these four core love stories, the sources do hint at a much wider world of folklore, right? It wasn't just these big famous ones.
Oh, absolutely. While the specific sources we're looking at don't catalog, you know, dozens of other specific tales from Afrin itself, they do reference broader Kurdish folktale collections. They mention titles like Hesokupo, or that rather descriptive one, The Molasses, The Mouse, and the Old Woman's Urine Pot, from a collection called Sherokin Jileri.
Right, showing the sheer diversity. Humorous tales, teaching tales.
Exactly. Stories reflecting everyday life, not just the grand or the tragic. And we can reasonably infer other genres were likely part of Afrin's oral world, based on what we know about Kurdish folklore generally.
Like what?
Animal fables, probably. Trickster figures, Keselak is a common one. Moral tales, proverbs, riddles. All these forms contribute to the richness of an oral culture.
And the sources also touch on how stories actively reinforce social norms, didn't they?
Yes, they specifically mention hospitality mevini as a deeply ingrained Kurdish value. It's highly likely that many tales told in Afrin provided social scripts, guidance on behavior, embodying the community's ethics.
And holding all this together, transmitting it, the storyteller figure must have been crucial.
Absolutely central. The dengbej, the voice singer, the bard. In Kurdish culture, these figures are traditionally the vital custodians of memory.
The ones who could recite the epics from memory.
Yes, capable of memorizing and performing incredibly long narratives, epics like Memu Zin or others like Dimdim, but also shorter stories like Zembil Farosh.
Did the sources mention specific dengbejes active in Afrin before 2010?
Our specific sources don't name formal professional dengbejes active in Afrin pre-2010 in the way they might be known elsewhere. But the function of the dengbej was clearly alive and well.
Through people like Zarifa Hanan.
Exactly. Skilled narrators, elders within the community, they were essentially performing that vital role. They were the living archives, the educators, the crucial link in the chain of cultural memory.
And that really highlights the vulnerability, doesn't it?
It really does. The sources hammer this point home. The displacement of people after 2010 poses an existential threat to this entire oral tradition.
It breaks the chain.
It severs those links between the storytellers and their communities, between the past and the future. And that's precisely why documenting that pre-2010 state was and still is so incredibly urgent.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Rojabash, Hannah.
Ah, perfect timing. Just as we were talking about keeping traditions alive.
Look at that. Piping hot today. Smells good.
Let's see. Ooh, definitely hot. Careful.
Mm. Yeah, very hot indeed. How is it? Good.
It's good. Strong. Maybe. maybe a touch bitter today. Could use just a tiny bit more sugar for me, perhaps.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Still,
yeah.
It's proper chai. Hits the spot. Let's just take a moment here.
Good idea.
Pause.
Mm? That's better.
All right. Feeling warmed up. It's been quite a landscape.
We have, from the grand epics like Mem-Uzin and Kawa.
Right, the foundational myths.
To those incredibly cherished, often tragic, love stories like Siabendu Sisi, Zembil Firosh, Fehad Ushirin.
And remember, there was a whole tapestry of other folktales, too.
Exactly. And the key thing the sources consistently emphasize is that these were never just, you know, simple entertainment.
Far more than that.
They were repositories of history, mirrors of community values, expressions of identity, outlets for anxieties, for dreams. Dynamic cultural assets, really. Transmitting consciousness, norms, ethics, belonging.
And we keep circling back to that difficult reality. The post-2010 events putting these traditions under such severe threat.
Yes. The disruption of communities, the scattering of people, the tragic loss of elders who were the living libraries. It's devastating for an oral culture.
But the research itself, documenting Afrin's pre-2010 folklore, it offers more than just a sad record, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It provides crucial insights, actually. Insights into cultural adaptation, into the sheer resilience of oral traditions, even under pressure, and into the many ways identity is constructed and maintained through narrative.
And looking at Afrin's specific mix of stories, what does that tell us?
Well, that unique constellation, the prominence of tragic love stories alongside Zembil Farosh's moral focus, the deep roots in pan-Kurdish myths like Kawa, combined with maybe more localized favorites, it reveals something about Afrin's distinct regional identity within the broader Kurdish culture.
That focus on tragic love may be reflecting a shared history of struggle and loss, transformed into art.
That's certainly a strong interpretation suggested by the sources, yes. Turning pain into narrative, into shared meaning.
So ultimately, the sources really underscore the vital need for this kind of documentation, this kind of study.
Absolutely vital. For the Afrini people themselves, obviously, as a way to connect with and preserve their heritage, but also invaluable for anyone seeking to understand the depth, the richness, and the endurance of Kurdish culture as a whole.
So here's a final thought, maybe for you, the listener, to take away. Given how deeply these stories were woven into the fabric of community life, identity, memory in Afrin before 2010, what happens to a culture when the physical places these stories are tied to are changed, or when the people carrying these stories in their hearts and minds are scattered far and wide? How does a community even begin to continue telling its story then?
A heavy question, but an important one.
Definitely something to reflect on. Thank you for joining us for this exploration into Afrin's pre-2010 narrative landscape in the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Yes, thank you for listening.